Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Before we get going here, just a weather-related item. We are expecting bad weather starting this afternoon, extending into tonight and tomorrow in central Illinois. All of our severe weather coverage area is under some kind of advisory or warning. There is an ice storm warning for the more northerly counties and a freezing rain advisory for the more southerly. Champaign is included in that. That's going to mean that beginning sometime this afternoon, through the night into tomorrow, travel is going to be difficult, to say the least. We're expecting there probably will be a number of weather-related closings, and we have the first one. Thomasboro schools will be dismissing at 1:30, and there will be no afternoon preschool. I expect there'll be more. When we get them, we'll bring them to you. If you're planning on attending some event tonight, you probably should call ahead to see if it's actually going to happen. And, of course, if you can avoid travel tonight, it probably would be a good idea. We'll have more on the weather as things develop for you throughout the day. Earlier this fall, Congress gave the Treasury Department the authority to spend hundreds of billions of dollars to prevent the collapse of the country's financial system. A lot of people said that was necessary. At the same time, many people said that it was really American working people who were in danger of losing their homes and jobs. These are the ones that really needed the government's help. This morning in this part of the show, we'll try to talk a little bit about government intervention and worker rights in a time of economic crisis. And our guest with the program is Nelson Lichtenstein. He is a professor of history, particularly interested in labor history. He teaches at the University of California at Santa Barbara. He's director of the Center for the Study of Work, Labor, and Democracy there. And he's joining us this morning by telephone. As we talk, questions and comments are certainly welcome. The only thing that we ask of people who call in is that people just try to keep their comments and questions brief, and we just ask that so we can keep the program moving and get in as many different people as possible. But questions, comments, certainly welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. At any point here, you're certainly welcome to call. Professor Lichtenstein, hello.
Hello there.
Thanks very much for talking with us.
Glad to be here.
You know, the thing that I thought we might talk about to begin with, and perhaps the thing that caught our attention in the first place, was the thing that happened at Republic Windows and Doors in the Chicago area a couple of weeks ago, which struck me as being something pretty remarkable. At least I can't remember a time something like this happened. This was when, and I'm sure that people have heard about this, it got national coverage, when the workers there at this place where they made windows and doors were told that in a matter of days, the factory would be closing. And so they decided to occupy the factory and ask only for what they were entitled to. And it turned out successful for them, but it seemed to me to be sort of a remarkable thing that it happened at all. And that it worked out as well as it did for the workers.
Yes, you're not the only one who found that to be the case. It's almost as the reaction to this sit-in is as important and as the sit-in itself. I mean, it evoked almost universal applause. I mean, there was no one anywhere who at least a pipe. Was willing to assert publicly they didn't agree with it. I mean it's quite remarkable across the board. I think this gets to the key here. There was a sense that the workers were not just legally or technically correct, but they were morally right in a very fundamental sense. And I think that that links them to other instances of dramatic activity by workers or other individuals, civil rights activists or feminists or others, who do things that otherwise would be considered illegal or oddball, but which when they do it is seen as correct and furthermore sort of speaking for the nation as a whole. I mean, there have been sit-ins at various times and places in in history. I mean, just a few years ago in Argentina, there was a widespread wave of sit-ins. In the United States, the most famous ones, of course, were in the 30s, and lots of people sort of evoked the memory of those sit-ins. The thing that linked them together, the sit-in recently, was not the, well, lots of differences, of course. This one in Chicago was very small, 200 workers, and all they were asking for was their severance pay, really. But the thing that linked them together between the dramatic sit-ins of the 30s was the sense that in both instances, the ownership of management was were kind of outlaws. They were sort of breaking the law, or were and were certainly not in accord with national purpose. In the 30s, there had been a law passed, the Wagner Act, designed to facilitate trade unionism. Roosevelt had signed it in June of 1935, and the large corporations of that day, General Motors and U.S. Steel, had said, well, we don't think this law is constitutional. In fact, we're not going to obey it. We're appealing it. We're taking it to the courts, and our lawyers tell us it's a bad law. So we just aren't going to, agree to it. And so there was a sense that the corporations were on the other wrong side of the law, and that the workers in occupying the factories and in seeking union recognition were in accord with a national purpose, and were in fact in effect enforcing the law, as it were. Well, the same thing was true with this Republic Windows and Doors. We passed this giant bailout, the whole point of which was to enable Bank of America and other financial institutions to extend credit to keep factories open, and what had happened was that Bank of America pulled the line of credit from Republic. Now, in normal circumstances, this would be considered prudent banking practice. The sales go down at Republic, which they did, and okay, the bank says, we don't think you can fulfill the terms of the loan, so we're going to withdraw the loan and cut our losses, and sorry, that's too bad, but you agreed to it. Well, but in this instance, the whole, as I say, the whole point was to keep credit flowing, and of course, sales were declining for everybody, auto industry, but all sorts of everyone's sales were declining. So there was a sense that the workers, in addition to being legally correct about demanding their severance pay, which was due them, were in accord with the national purpose.
So the thing, just what the workers were objecting to, they were objecting to the fact that, for example, there apparently is a law that says people have to be given notice before a plant closing, and that they weren't.
Yeah, right.
And, of course, they were really concerned about what was going to happen to them. I guess, one of the questions I have was, if they had not decided to take this very dramatic action that got attention for the situation, in fact, would anybody have come to their aid, or would they have been really stuck, literally out in the cold?
Yeah, what would have happened is this, that they wouldn't have done it. Maybe they were a unionized plant, but what might have happened is a lawyer, the union would have gotten a lawyer, okay, we'll sue, we'll go to court. Of course, no one would have known this, but, and then 7 months from now or 10 months from now, if the company had gone into actual bankruptcy, which I think it was about to do, they probably would have gotten maybe a few cents on the dollar what was owed to them, or maybe nothing at all, and certainly would have had no one would have known that. As it turned out, by sitting in, they highlighted the mendacity of both their local management, but since that local management was powerless, and I mean, that's a in fact, there's some indications that the local management was a kind of almost like a runaway shop. They were setting up another plant in western Iowa, but they really didn't have much money. But they really highlighted that Bank of America had been responsible. So the bank was completely worried that this claim by the workers was going to have a national impact on lending practices, and would get the federal the Treasury to insist that the Bank of America, alter its lending practices in terms of the $10 or $15 or $25 billion it had gotten. I mean, this is a real worry. So the bank rushed to do basically whatever the workers wanted. I mean, they just wanted to get rid of this thing, and they ponied up. The bank, I think, ended up ponying up about $1 million in an additional loan, which was then put in escrow. They didn't trust the local management, and they just said, "We just want to give you this money." And we know. The bank must have known they'll never get the money back. I mean, it was technically a loan to the local management, but the local management will go into bankruptcy, and so the bank is just. Put this money up to satisfy the workers, what it demonstrated was that that's what was so exciting was that when these workers had their own voice, and they did it in a dramatic fashion, and they were correct, and the president endorsed them in effect, then powerful institutions like the Bank of America was willing to accommodate them.
Just very quickly, let me introduce again the guest for this hour, Nelson Lichtenstein. He's professor of history at University of California, Santa Barbara. He's a labor historian. He's also director of the Center for the Study of Work, Labor, and Democracy there at UC Santa Barbara. Questions welcome as we talk about worker rights and conditions for workers in America today. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Something else that I'm interested in having you talk about, I think it's striking, as you say, that there was, I think, across the country a great deal of sympathy and support expressed for these workers. And I wonder whether you think that says something about how people, particularly people who are not union members, how people think about the idea of collective action by workers.
Well, right. That's a good point. I mean, I think here... here you're touching on an important question. In one sense, most people, these people were unionized. Actually, they were in the UE, a small union with a long, old radical tradition. 80% were Latino. And I think there's the sense that these workers together were willing to get court arrest. Many of them, when their sit-in was proposed, they didn't know it would be so successful, and they thought maybe the Chicago police will roust us from the plant, but maybe we make our point as we're being arrested by the Chicago police, sort of like a civil rights protest in that respect. But I think the fact they did it together, they weren't just sort of individuals, complaining in a letter to the editor or a call-in show or something like that. I think that has an impact. It provides an underpinning sense of that people aren't alone, and that if these 200 can do it, it's true for many others. Now the counterexample here, which needs to be put forward, is the auto situation. I'm sure we should mention that. But, just to touch on it in one sense, here, the UAW, leaving aside all the details, here there's a kind of, at least some Americans, some senators, thought this was that there was enough disdain for the collective actions of this union that they would simply, denounce it as the cause of the auto problems, and I think there's a difference here. I think that people, partly referencing the civil rights movement, that poor people, very poor people, marginal people, when they act collectively, there's sort of a sense, okay, maybe they are, morally correct. When people who are, seen as, or their images, they're kind of middle class, homeowners. But when they act collectively, there's something about, well, that's an interest group, and they have something, wrong with their sort of demands. I think there's a kind of a double standard going on here, and. Which needs a further elaboration. I'm sure your callers will have something to say about that. Yeah.
Well, we have someone here to bring into the conversation, so let's do that. Line number one, the caller is in Champaign. Hello.
Yes, this is a good segue because I wanted to ask you about the recent automobile industry and specifically the UAW. My questions, and I guess would just have to be why or does the Republican Party have an animus toward unions? If that's true, fine. If not, tell me why I'm wrong. Two, Does the fact that the Southern senators, Corker, Shelby, and the rest of them, where there are right-to-work laws, have an interest in, quote, busting the UAW, and that explains their recalcitrance in this whole matter? And three, I did hear a commentator refer to the UAW as being sort of a unique union and maybe one that should be subject to contempt because it was, quote, a privileged union, as opposed to whatever it would have been a non-privileged union. Can you comment on those three questions, sir?
Yeah, we're glad to. I think the caller has a good sense of this. Well, one thing, of course, is that why the Republicans don't like unions. The trade unions have been, and since the 30s, really, the backbone of the Democratic Party. I mean, they've been, in favor of a lot of things that the Democrats are in favor of. Expansion of the welfare state, higher minimum wages, things of that sort. So that's sort of just a straight political difference, that Republicans try to do things that will keep the unions out of politics or curb their influence, and in the same way that say the Democrats, the Democrats are think that role of the a business association, which is very clearly identified with Republicans, they sort of look askance at them. So that's one thing. When it comes to the Southern, obviously the Southern Republicans. Here you have a kind of return to a kind of regional politics, which used to exist stronger in America on economic questions, not on race or gender questions. The South has viewed a sort of a lower wages as an advantage, and they therefore viewed all sorts of efforts to have a national standard or to sustain northern wages as a kind of attack on it in some sense. Now, it turns out that the wages of assembly workers in the main assembly plants in the South at Honda and Nissan are about the same as those at Ford and Chrysler and GM. The real difference, of course, is the so-called legacy costs, the cost of the pensions and health care, et cetera, which exists in the North. Now, with the Southerners, as long as there is a UAW that exists and is kind of, every so often tries to organize the Southern plants, which it does, and it hasn't been successful, but it does it. As long as that's the case, the Southern assembly plants, the main plants down there, keep their wages high as a way of thwarting a UAW organizing effort. But if the UAW would disintegrate with the big three, and that would happen, the whole thing would sort of disintegrate, or if the Southerners successful in sort of mandating lower wages for the UAW, this would eliminate that threat, and then what would happen would be that in both North and South, the wages of workers at the main assembly plants would fall, and they're falling now, but they would fall to the level of what other sort of blue-collar men receive in distribution centers, parts plants, Walmart, places like that in the South, which is about $13 and $14 an hour max. That's what would happen, that's what Corker and other Shelby and these people are speaking. That's part of the reason that they're into this thing.
Okay, and what about the notion that the UAW may deserve harsher treatment because it's a privilege?
Well, yeah. Well, what the UAW did for many years. People looked to the UAW with admiration, and because it was the engine, along with the steel workers and other big industrial unions, packing house workers in Chicago, they were the engine that was establishing the higher living standard for all Americans. And so, in the 40s and 50s and 60s and 70s, when the UAW, which was much bigger in those days and organized more workers, would establish a higher wage level or get a new benefit, a supplemental unemployment insurance or health benefit, et cetera, then not just the UAW, but other workers, many of which were in non-union firms, certainly true of the white-collar workers in the auto industry or all sorts of other workers, workers for say, Kodak or IBM, which were non-union firms, they would get those benefits as well. This was called pattern bargaining, and the UAW would set the standard, everyone would follow. Well, what happened since the 1980s is that with the decimation of unionism, the rise of conservatism, pattern bargaining no longer works. The UAW no longer sets the pattern for other workers in other industries, certainly doesn't set the pattern for retail, for example, which is very poorly paid. Therefore, the UAW is sort of left as a kind of island. It's like a terrain in which there'd been an ocean, which retreats, or a lake. The general wage level declines. The lake declines, and you're left with these little islands of high wage, seemingly high wage workers. Around. The West Coast longshoremen, the UAW. These are sort of isolated pockets of high wage workers because the general wage level has declined, and so it seems privileged. But of course, the solution here, the issue, the way this should be resolved is not to tear down this little island of high wages, but to raise the general wage level of everyone else, and that is I think integral to the Obama stimulus plan, because what has happened in the last 7 or 8 years is exactly what happened in the 1920s. We've had very good productivity growth in the last decade or so, but we've had wage stagnation. And therefore, everyone says this, Krugman and columnist Paul Krugman and others say this, that the reason for the housing bust is that while housing prices were going up, wages were stagnant. So in order to get to the root cause of this economic difficulty we have, we need a program which will put money into the hands of the working people in this country. And so rather than tearing down this island of high wages, we should be raising the rest.
Thank you, sir.
All right. Thank you for the call. We are just about at our midpoint of this hour of Focus 580. We have some other callers. We'll continue to talk with our guest for this hour, Nelson Lichtenstein. He's professor of history at the University of California, Santa Barbara. He's a labor historian. He's also director of the Center for the Study of Work, Labor, and Democracy. We're trying to talk a little bit about conditions for working folks here in America at this point when things are so difficult economically. And the questions are certainly welcome. When I have a moment here, let me bring you some more weather-related information. As I mentioned at the beginning of the program, we're expecting could be some serious problems with freezing rain beginning sometime this afternoon and throughout the night and into tomorrow. And we're expecting there will be a number of weather-related closings, and I have a few, and let me bring them to you. Judah Christian School in Champaign will be dismissing at 3:30 today. There will be no after-school care for grades K through 6, and all evening activities and rehearsals are canceled. So again, if you have some activity scheduled for tonight, you might want to check and see if it's still on. And, of course, travel is discouraged for the evening. Professor Lichtenstein, again, thanks for being with us. We certainly appreciate it. We'll go on here to talk with some other folks. And for people who are listening, by the way, also, of course, calls are welcome, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. We'll talk next with someone here in Urbana, where we are. That's line 2. Hello.
Hi. Yes. Thanks for taking my call, and thanks for having this program. You're talking about the need to raise the general wage level in the analogy between, current events and the 1930s. One of the things that the Roosevelt administration did was pass the National Labor Relations Act, and I'm struck that in the context of the current crisis, there's so little discussion, it seems like, in the public sphere of the Employee Free Choice Act and what that would mean. It's sort of portrayed when it appears at all as, well, this is something that the unions want, and Obama promised, but now there's pressure not to do that, and one doesn't see commentators saying, this is something that we need to do to reverse the phenomenon that you were just describing about the island and the isolation of the pockets, the need to raise the general wage level. So I wondered if you would comment on that.
Yes. Just to say what it is, the Employee Free Choice Act is a proposed piece of legislation which would enable, which would help union organizing, and it would do this by enabling when workers signed a simple card indicating they wanted to be part of the union, and once they'd had 51% of those cards were signed in a given workplace, then the National Labor Relations Board would automatically certify the union. It's a very controversial piece of legislation, and I think it's sort of incumbent on me to say just another word about it, why it's so controversial. The business community is totally mobilized today against it, and one of their major arguments is saying, look, this is undemocratic. What's wrong with having the NLRB election? Elections are you know, we have go in, people go into a voting booth or a little, you know, and vote. That's more democratic than having people sign cards. We don't do that, you know, we don't do that in national elections. Well, the problem is that over the last 50, 60 years, the National Labor Relations Board election has been turned into an employer tool for preventing unionism. And just as the State Department condemns elections in various, you know, countries that are not free around the world because of the intimidation and propagandization and sort of one party power that's exercised before workers go into the ballot box, and then say, look, just because you go to a ballot box doesn't mean the election's free. The same is true with the NLRB. That is, the courts and the NLRB itself have made a whole series of activities on the part of companies legal. And really are intimidation on their surface. So, for example, the most notorious one is called captive audience meetings, where the workers are brought into a meeting and are lectured and berated really by management to vote against the union, for hours if necessary, and shown. And Walmart shows films and has a whole system for doing this, and the union supporters, both from outside the plant and inside the office of the store, they can't talk, they can't raise their hand, they can be thrown out of the room if they disagree with management. So it's really quite undemocratic. Anyway, that's what the Employee Free Choice Act will do. I should say that I've written a book on Walmart entitled The Retail Revolution, and I have a couple chapters on Walmart's labor practices, and it's so clear here that here's a company which now employs 2 million people worldwide, 1.4 million in the U.S., which is now setting the pattern. Walmart is setting the pattern for workers in a wide range of occupations and industries. Retail is employs more people than manufacturing. And the wages are low relatively low, in large part because there is no self-organization of workers in virtually any retail. I mean, very, very, very small, and certainly none at Walmart. And so, a law that would facilitate unionization would be one mechanism, to raise working class incomes. That's what Roosevelt made integral to the stimulus package of his day, which was the National Industrial Recovery Administration, and part of that program of 1933 gave a lot to what business wanted and made it easier for business to raise prices and make money, and it also gave to the workers the right to self-organization. And I think today, I think the caller's right. Today, I'm sure that, I mean, Obama has officially endorsed the Employee Free Choice Act, but it's clear that he's afraid of this tremendous business opposition if he makes it a priority. And there's a much indication that some of the Democrats are waffling on this, and I think it appears to be smart politics. Oh, we don't want to, you know, get all the business elements mad at us, but really, in the long run, without a renewal of the labor movement, the Democratic Party will struggle in the future.
All right. Well, let me just quickly, you know, one of the things that we know is that the percentage of workers in America belonging to unions has been going down in the whole post-war period, although interestingly enough, apparently last year there was actually a little uptick, the first in a couple of decades. But, and I'm sure that there are a number of reasons for that decline in union membership. What I wonder is to what extent that has to do with a deliberate attempt on the part of business to make it difficult, and on the other hand, a feeling on the part of workers that they don't really see anything in it for them.
Well, yeah, two things. 15 years ago, 20 years ago, we had lots of discussions of globalization and the fact that, especially industrial plants in the North were fleeing the country, and therefore unionism was declining. And that's a certain truth to that. But most people in America work in the service sector, and here in retail, in banking, in these areas, business has indicated it's sort of adamant opposition to trade unionism. And so, like at Walmart, if let's assume that most people who work at Walmart don't like unions, don't want to be in them. But let's assume there's 10% of all Walmart workers want to be in a union. That wouldn't be an unusual statistic if you took a survey. Actually, it's more than that. But let's assume that. Well, where's the 10% of the Walmart stores that are unionized? Where are the 400 Walmart stores that are union? There are zero. There are zero Walmart stores that are union. Okay, so corporate management has decided that it's against unions, and since there are so few penalties for either breaking the law or skirting the law against unionism, that they just do it. Now, as for the mentality of the ordinary American worker, blue-collar, white-collar, pink-collar, there have been many, many surveys that have been taken which show that workers want some form of collective voice. They want that. They don't want to go on strike. They don't want to have divisiveness. They don't want to be, mad at the boss in kind of their daily activities. But they want a sense of collective voice. They even want a trade. Even when you said you want a trade union, 40% and 50% say they want a trade union as well. But when you talk about collective voice, some sort of assembly, some sort of a, then it goes up to 60%, 70%, 80%. But there's no mechanism in the law to accommodate that. So we have in the private sector, unionism's down to about 8%, and that's higher in the public sector, but it's quite low. Mm-hmm. And this is therefore a kind of a systemic legal political question. It's not some individual person had a bad experience and therefore it's decided they don't want it or they don't need it. That's often a refrain. Well, they were okay for the 30s, but we don't need them today. Everything's better. Well, today, in fact, I think everyone's making analogies to the 30s, and so, they're needed today.
Mm-hmm. All right. Let's talk with someone next here where we are in Champaign County. It's line 3. Hello.
Hi. There's some more aspects of the Republic window occupation that I think it seems to me, as well as Bank of America getting the largesse. Apparently, J.P. Morgan actually owned the physical plant, the actual machinery, and I don't know if that's still there. There's actually a glimmer of a rumor that they want to reopen it, or the workers want to reopen it as a worker collective or some kind of worker-owned outfit. I don't know if that's really going anywhere, but the fact that they were basically using this downturn as an opportunity to move the equipment and the production to Iowa, where they could pay, I think, maybe something like approaching half, two-thirds of what they were paying in Chicago, it illustrates how they want to take advantage of it, actually, the opportunity in some ways. They know there will be at some time. Anyway, I wanted you to, and it seems to me that since there are a lot of Latinos there, they know some of the examples in the world for owner occupying or worker occupying plants and reopening them. So there's that. I'd like a follow up, but I
the caller's right about that. The it's been underreported the role of the local management, and they seem to be pretty crass crew. What they were doing is that in the month or 2 months before this sit-in, they were the union got wind and actually sent observers down there at midnight to the plant. They were moving machinery out of the plant. This is sort of the index that they were ready to shut it, not just shut it down, but to reopen somewhere else. They set up a shell corporation, a different legal corporation, and rented or bought this facility in western Iowa, and where they're began to hire people there at lower wages and non-union. So it's a kind of a classic sort of runaway shop. That's one thing. And then they, you know, illegally, abruptly closed down without giving the workers notice. And then when there was negotiations later on, when Bank of America came in and said, yes, we're going to pay some of the severance pay, the owner of this company, I mean, had the audacity to demand that Bank of America pay for his Lexus. I think it was a Lexus, which he had put on the cost of it had made it. He was technically owned by the company, but he was using it, and he sort of insisted that the Bank of America pay for this. And Bank of America said, no, we aren't going to do it. And I think this held up the negotiations for hours. And finally, the manager caved. But there hasn't been enough look at that. I mean, obviously this local management of this small plant, that, you know, what they were doing is what hundreds and thousands of other local managements do. They, you know, they flee from they weren't really high wages. They were making $14 an hour, but they flee from one place to another in order to cut costs. And, you know, in the context of a national crisis, where Obama, you know, they're going to put a stimulus package of, you know, $700 billion or more, then these kind of activities just seem unpatriotic, because the point of the stimulus package is to, you know, get money out there into the hands of construction workers and home health care workers and service workers and teachers and public officials, public civil servants who are in the verge of being laid off by the states, which are strapped for money. So I mean, so that's the point. And then when you have a firm which is trying to cut corners in this way, it just has an almost unpatriotic ring to it.
Well, it seems to me that you're sort of putting a lot on the onus on this local operator, but he wouldn't have been able to move J.P. Morgan's equipment without getting a nod from them, and they may have just needed a rather smarter operator when he's going the line to get his Lexus paid for. He obviously doesn't know anything about PR. And,
yeah, right.
I wanted to ask you a more provocative question in a way. I know you did the book on Walmart. Refresh us about the advisor to Obama that says that Walmart is good for workers. And how do you reflect on all of that? And,
right.
And there hasn't been that much discourse about who the Department of Labor is going to go to. You already talked about the waffling on the free choice association.
Well,
so I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Yeah, Jason Furman is a smart young economist who is a Walmart, who is Obama's one of his key economic advisors, and he published an article three years ago. Which said Walmart was a quote progressive company in that because it was saving people, working class people, money, and therefore should not be condemned. And so, for example, in Chicago, where there's a big fight by keeping Walmart out, that this was a mistake, that you should allow Walmart to come in. Now, there is the truth and short-sightedness in this piece. On the one hand, it is true, there has been a kind of retail revolution. That's my title of my book, to plug it, my forthcoming book. There has been a retail revolution, which is like the invention of the assembly line. Productivity is much higher in retail. There's a whole system involving containerization, stuff from China, the barcodes, data mining. There's a whole sort of innovation in retail in the last two decades, which Walmart was pioneered. And as a result, it's true, prices at Walmart stores are lower than, say, they would have been, buying from an old-fashioned Macy's or some department store in the old days. And of course, that innovation has now spread to Target and Lowe's and all the other big stores. So there is prices are lower in real terms. Okay, getting the stuff from China, whether you already think about that, but that has lowered the price. Now, having said that, that's not enough, because two things. One is that you don't buy everything at Walmart. You don't buy health insurance. You don't buy education. You don't buy cars. You don't buy houses at Walmart. And in general, the prices of those things have gone to make an increasingly larger part of the family budget over the years compared to groceries and clothing and things like that. So while you save money at Walmart on some things, you don't at others. However, what will pay for houses and education and health care? Higher wages pay for those. You can't buy them at Walmart, but you can buy them with higher wages. And insofar as Walmart has kept a lid on wages and also has eroded the standard of health care with its particular program, its particular health care offerings. I could go into this in a little more detail if you want, but I'll leave it aside for the moment. Insofar as they've done that, Walmart is now setting the wage pattern and the benefit pattern for millions and millions of other workers in the country, and that is keeping a kind of you know, it's one of the reasons for wage stagnation, you know, in the last decade or two. And so I think that they're contradictory impulses there. Yes, prices have come down, but wages have not gone up. And in fact, I think if you look at the total sort of the thing together, the impact on the standard of living of Walmart has been negative rather than positive. And one more thing, which has to do with unions and collective voice and workers. When you have a institution like Walmart, which is internally really almost a sort of authoritarian kind of institution, with its own ministry of propaganda, this is not good for American democracy. This is not good. And Roosevelt in the 30s, he said this, unions were not just there to raise wages. That was something. But they were also there to invigorate American democracy. And I think that's true. That's needed at these so many of these retail and service sector workplaces.
We have about 10 minutes left in this hour of Focus 580. Our guest is Nelson Lichtenstein. He's professor of history at the University of California at Santa Barbara. He's director of the Center for the Study of Work, Labor, and Democracy. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. And we'll continue. We'll talk next with someone in Effingham, line number 4, toll-free line. Hello.
Yes, one comment and a question. The capitalist paradigm, I think, is defunct and has been so for probably the last 100 years. That just as a comment. My question is about labor relations. Here in Effingham, we have an institution that is state-operated called Heartland Human Services. And the ladies there, there are a few men work there too, but mostly it's women, care of the mentally disturbed and other social and health problems. They have been on strike. They were on strike for 12 months. No negotiations, no hint that they were going to be scheduling them. Then the ladies offered to go back to work with their union. They're an AFSCME local, you know, that is a fairly large union. And then they were locked out and have been locked out now for 7 months. And the labor process, that is my question. Why aren't the people who represent the labor organizations, not necessarily the union, but I think you referred to the Department of Labor and some of those, there are certain rules, if I understand properly, that must be followed to negotiate and to arbitrate and to bring these things to resolution. But here, 17 months, and these ladies have had no redress. The management refuses to talk to them. The board that operates the thing is silent. The last incident was that the head of the place there came and ignored the workers, and they have a little building there at the side of the entry, which they had to fight for that, where they can picket continually. And then the police were there and escorted the manager of Heartland, implying that those women were going to be violent. And that was the most egregious breach, I think, between management and labor that I know that over time, that's where the police have always played their part in the National Guard and other such things, you know, back to the 30s again. But in your venue of study and knowing the law, isn't there laws that say this is going to happen? You're going to sit down, we're going to bring in a federal mediator if we have to, and then an arbitrator and get the thing settled.
Yeah, well, I don't know the details there, but it seems to me that you're speaking of the kind of situation where you have this Heartland is a contractor for the state, probably gets a lot of its money from the state for these services, but it's technically, you know, independent, you know, run by a separate board, and it's sort of been outsourced, as it were. Maybe it's been there for many years, but nevertheless, it's sort of really a state function, taking care of people who are in need, but done in a technically private firm. Yeah, and often the most resistant to unionization are these kind of firms or even nonprofits that contract from the state, in part because the state is not giving them enough money, and so they're trying to cut corners. And the only way place they can cut corners, they're often very labor intensive. They cut corners with their staff, and they don't want to pay them enough or negotiate with them over other questions like staffing ratios, which is often very important. It's certainly true for the nurses and hospitals. And staffing is very expensive, but absolutely essential. If you have people in need, you must have people there to take care of them. But it's expensive. So I mean, it seems to me that this is the kind of reform where we need a vigorous federal presence and state presence to in effect threaten this institution that, you know, your funding will be withdrawn unless you reach an agreement with the workers, in some accommodation. And I mean, that's done in terms of, for example, desegregation. The Nixon administration said to Southern school boards, unless you integrate, you know, your funds will be withdrawn. Well, the same sort of thing should be in the vast influence of the federal budget. Unless you agree to you obey the labor law, then we will, you know, then your funding will be threatened. That's not the case today in so many places. I mentioned the Secretary of Labor, right? I think this is the very last of the Obama cabinet posts which has not been filled, and it's what's going on here. I think that there's probably a lot of discussions going on about how forthright and pro-union Secretary of Labor they intend to appoint, and exactly who that will be. And I think it does reflect Obama's, you know, he has his own priority, which is healthcare reform, the stimulus package, and labor law reform. I think he's probably decided to put that off a bit, which from the point of view of the labor movement is a mistake. Point of view of America is a mistake, because unless you push this forward when he has all this momentum and goodwill, it will die on the vine, as other efforts at labor law reform have died in years past.
We just have about 2 minutes. I have one more caller I want to try to get here in Urbana on line one. I have to ask you to be quick, but please go ahead.
Yes, I wonder if you would give your thoughts on what an earlier caller raised, which is the possibility of creating worker cooperatives where workers actually control the plants. One of the big impediments has been credit. Where would they get the credit? Now that the government's involved in offering credit, perhaps in something like the automobile industry, if management doesn't assume its responsibilities, why not turn it over to the workers? Workers could hire management if they need it and hold management responsible to the workers. What do you think about that? I mean, we have it in the Northwest, in the lumber industry. We have some cooperatives, Mondragon in Spain. It's a very democratic form. Could you address that?
Yes, they've been sort of an inspiration for progressives for many years, there are instances where they exist. They set them up in the 30s quite a bit, and in the late 19th century. Where in certain particular circumstances we should, you know, there should be a kind of credit bank, as it were, a bank which looks favorably upon these things and gives credit. I don't think that they are a solution in general. As long as we have a sort of basically a market capitalist society, you know, you can ameliorate that, you can regulate that, but with like the auto industry, you know, this is, you could nationalize it in a way under a kind of federal board far more easily than you could have individual units of it, you know, which are on the verge of going bankrupt, or being being taken over by the individual, the workers there. I mean, I would not put, at this instance, put a lot of energy into that solution. Rather, I would seek to regulate and provide capital for these larger units of industry.
I guess we're down to the point here. I can give you about 30 seconds to answer the question, but I guess I'm interested in finishing up. Do you think that now in the few years to come, we're going to see more labor organizing activism than we have seen in the past?
It's possible, especially if Obama could use the bully pulpit, which is one of the tools of a president, to say it's a good thing to join unions.
Well, at that, we'll have to leave it. Our guest this morning in this hour of Focus 580, Nelson Lichtenstein. He's professor of history at the University of California, Santa Barbara. He's also director of the Center for the Study of Work, Labor, and Democracy there at UC Santa Barbara. Just remind us again the book that you mentioned about Walmart. What's the title?
The title is The Retail Revolution, and it'll be coming out in the late spring from Metropolitan Books.
Well, thank you very much for talking with us.
You're welcome.